That's the creative part, which leads me to the cultish creative project that you have going on and the idea of a personal archive. So if you indulge me, tell me more, what's that all about?
So in the great tradition of doing things by accident, but doing them persistently, I had a sense, a feeling, a realization, and this goes back to like, I'm coming into my 30s and whatever else. And it's full fire hose consumption mode on. I'm working in finance at this point. And so I'm in just like absorb as much as possible. And so I think in that mode of discovery, you start figuring out a ways how to like record stuff and you start taking notes and you start jotting stuff away. But I realized probably around 2015-ish that the act of just collecting all these notes was I just had all of these notes. And at first I didn't know what I was doing, but the idea was spend a minute and make it a complete thought. And I started doing this just by myself, for myself for a while. And then right around 2017, I decided, you know what I'm going to do is, and I was inspired by Shane Parrish at Farnham Street from back in the financial crisis when it was Berkshire zip code or whatever it was, the website, and somebody sent it to me and Seth Godin and people like this. I was like, there's something about putting it out in the world, even if nobody's going to see it.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question. What it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, Search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is Matt Ziegler. He's a managing director and private wealth advisor at SunPoint Investments. He helps clients create, align, and manage their financial plans and investment strategies. Matt's talent turned skill is engaging people on their level. In his words, finance may be complex, but it doesn't have to be complicated. Outside of work, Matt has had a long-standing interest in all things creativity and culture-related. He was born and raised in Pennsylvania, received his undergraduate degree in music from the University of Hartford, and has resided in Connecticut for over 20 years. You can find him with his eyes on a book, his ears in some music, his nose over the stove, his feet on a trail, and his mind on the markets, and the markets on his mind. I've been greatly enjoying his cultish creative blog posts, and I highly recommend them. Today we talk about a variety of topics. I especially enjoyed hearing about Matt's experience straddling both music and investing in his life. He tells us what the two have in common. We have a longer discussion about curiosity, ideas, and we bring up Rick Rubin, Joseph Campbell, Rory Sutherland, and many more. Stay tuned until the end when we talk about how the world works and how to make it work for you. It's an all-around fun, deep, entertaining, and educational conversation. All right. Please help me welcome Matt Ziegler. There you go. Okay, how are you with that? Well, hi, Matt. It's so nice to see you again. How are you?
It's so good to see you again, Bogumil.
you and I spoke a few weeks ago and we were not recording and we had no agenda and we had no questions. And I think we filled up an hour. And now looking back, I wish we were recording. So maybe we can bring back some of that magic today. But
we're going to try. We're going to try.
We're going to try. But before I ask you about everything you do and your writing and your career, I want to start from the beginning. And I like to ask my guests about their childhood and upbringing and how you think that time shaped you and led you to the career that you're in right now. And I always like to ask about the relationship with money. So if you indulge me, maybe find a way to include that too.
So a version of the story that I like to tell on this, and don't think you're going to get away from me asking you questions on this too, because this is very intriguing to me to sit down with you again. I connect money and the experiences with money always back to business. I can't separate those in my mind. And I think this is why. So I was always a very musical kid. I always wanted to play music growing up. I've got pictures of my mother and her siblings. And like when the family would get together, everybody would have guitars, everybody would be singing. It was always a good time. And mm-hmm. So I just always wanted to play music growing up. And that led to, you know, being as one does, you're a teenager and whatever else. And you start to play in bands with my friends. And then just kind of like dumb luck, extra Back to the Future style, one of a band that was like all older people, all professional musicians, music teachers and professionals alike, something happened to the guitar player. And my mom actually was a teacher with one of the band members. And that band member knew me from playing in like local jazz bands and like stuff you do when you're a kid in middle school and like high school. And he needed a guitar player. And he asked my mom, can you let him come play in our band? And I'm like 15 years old. And so I spend my high school years after working one summer in construction being like, this is work. This sucks. I end up getting to play in this basically corporate event, wedding and cover band, doing like soul and Motown and all this other stuff. And the great thing about being a kid in a bar is you can't just like leave a kid in a bar or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I got to see how these people like ran a business. And I didn't know what I was learning at the time, mm-hmm. but in high school, I was learning how to build, operate, run a team, run a business, figure out how to make sure it's profitable and everything from contract negotiations. Cause again, you're sitting there and you're bored and you're often stuffed in a back room and it's like, oh, here's the contract for tonight. Oh, this is what a rider is. Oh, hey, why do we put, why does like this part of the band equipment like go in the LLC, but this part's personal, like asking all those questions.
Good one.
I didn't know I was learning business, but that's what I was doing. So a cool thing that happens is like, I've got the professional band and then I've got, you know, whatever you want to call the band you're in with your friends and same mm-hmm. thing then repeats in college. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most important things about, so the relationship with money, which is the relationship with business to me, is this like two track, idea in parallel. Mm-hmm. Where on one hand, you have like your mentors or the people you're learning from and working with. And on the other hand, it's me trying to recreate that with my friends and my bands and do it for myself. Mm. And I think that's a really interesting thing. And I'm really curious with you because you've hinted at this before and I didn't get to ask you this last time. So like Poland, the world opens up, you start doing stuff. Uh-huh. Like when do you start realizing you're good at the business side of this too? And did you have like a similar two-track experience like I did where it was like mentor side and then personal figure it out on myself side?
Wow, it's a big one. And I don't want to take up your airtime because you're the guest.
Okay, I'll come back and interview for one too. No. Can you indulge me for at least a second on this?
Of course. So I think there was a collection of principles that I was aware of and I was witnessing as a kid growing up. And I remember going grocery shopping with my grandma and she had a very clear idea of what's price, what's value, which I later discovered that's a whole, you know, school of thought in investing. And she would negotiate the price and these tomatoes were better than the other tomatoes. And I started to pay attention to those things. And when I learned about investing, I discovered Peter Lynch and then Warren Buffett. And I thought, this is like going grocery shopping with my grandma. This is the same idea. Only the difference is that I get to become an owner in a collection of businesses because stocks are small pieces of businesses. So it all clicked. But money to me always had a meaning and a context, and it wasn't a goal in itself. I just could see what money can do, and especially having a peace of mind that there is something saved that allows you to have some choices and options. And I think that's what I see now in my professional pursuit, working with clients, where I see that I know who the clients are. You know, people are in the investment profession managing big funds and they have a million shareholders and everybody put in $100. They don't know whose money it is. They don't know the context. I do. I know the individuals. I know the stories. I've become a part of their life and they've become a part of my life. And that means something to me. And I feel responsible. I feel like I earned their trust. It's a whole different relationship, a lifelong relationship that you build with your clients. And then I know the businesses behind it. But in general, my interest in business, I think I was discovering in steps. So in Poland, there was a city with a lot of old textile mills, kind of rhymes with Berkshire because that was a textile business. And many of them were abandoned at the time because the textile business would move away. But they looked massive. They're so big. They were bigger than the churches. They were bigger than the government buildings. And for many years, there was no use of them. And now only the last decade or two, they were converted into malls and movie theaters and so on. So as a kid, I would ask questions, what was here? And then I would hear stories about the families that own those businesses. So as a kid, I was just curious about what it means to create a business, what it means for a business to last, why some of them are gone. And then I would fill in all those gaps through my education and learning about, you know, Berkshire Hathaway. It rhymed with my childhood because I walked around abandoned textile mills as a kid, looking up and thinking. And there are movies and documentaries where you can see when the machines were running and it was noisy and there were people coming in every day and it was alive. And why is it gone? What happened? You know, competition, low cost and so on. You know, the creative distraction that happens in the business. So I think I was collecting all those little lessons and I didn't know yet how they will play a role down the road.
It's so interesting because two things, like the connection between price and value, the idea in knowing people, because I feel the same way about this with like the clients that I work with too professionally. Mm-hmm. Like I want to know them and I want to know their story just the same way. I don't see the things we invest in necessarily like as money so much as businesses. That's just something I can't ever get out of my head too. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting that both of us had this formative experience because like you're describing almost the same thing, that the place where I'm from in Pennsylvania is where mm-hmm. coal was the dominant industry.
Right.
And like we have the first transcontinental railroad was built out of Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is just up the road from me. And it was uh-huh. built because that's how we got the coal and the steel out to the rest of the country in America to build it. Mm-hmm. But post-World War II, like the whole area just kind of like falls apart as coal's no longer king. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up the same thing. You have this whole downtown. It's you're in a city, but it's a city that looks like this almost abandoned city mm-hmm. with all these old factories and all these other things. They would be blowing up the towers that they would sort coal on when I was a kid. I have mm-hmm. memories of getting the notices and hearing the bang and them collapsing. And sometimes it would get out and you'd ride off on bikes with your friends to see them. And other times it would be like, what the heck was that noise? You know, like shocked and startled. The first place I ever played music as a kid. So I'm like 14-ish years old in my first band mm-hmm. and we get a gig and we're playing out and the building was in an old hotel and this mm-hmm. old hotel was basically abandoned. It's since been torn down, but you're not supposed to sneak out into the building when you're a kid. We snuck out into the building. Of course we did. don't tell my mom. I think she knows now, but still. So we sneak out into the building. So this building sits across a bridge. It's in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And like this building, when you got out into the main room, like the coffee shop that we were playing in was this little thing on the side street. But when you mm-hmm. got into the main thing of the building, it had a two-story staircase, like a full marble, the kind that's like a room wide, the thing you only see in movies from like, you know, the 30s and the 40s mm-hmm. Or the 20s and the 40s, I guess. But anyway, like that building and then learning about it later in life, like it had a presidential suite at the top floor. Every president up to the end of World War II stayed in that hotel.
Wow.
But then my entire upbringing Like it became dilapidated. It got torn down a few years ago. And when you grow up with like the myth of capitalism staring you in the face, but then are looking for the soul of business, it's such an interesting thing to be raised in. I think it definitely changes your perspective.
You called it a soul. And I let's explore that a bit, because when you learn the history of Berkshire Hathaway, when you dig deep, Adam Mead had this incredible book about Berkshire. You realize that the initial capital that went into the textile mills came from the whaling fortunes of the Northeast. And that capital, obviously, you know, there are no whaling businesses anymore, and there are very few, if any, textile mills that survived. But the capital, or if you call it the soul, continues and continues all the way. So when you think about it, that the nugget of capital that funded the whaling business now goes on all the way, and it's part of Apple. It's one of the big holdings, you know, public information of Berkshire Hathaway. The soul continued through all this transformation and entire businesses and industries disappearing. I call it, you know, an infinite investment horizon with finite assets. So the assets will continue to expire. And I think there's a certain acceptance of it when you think about it, especially over a very long period of time, how you and I are interacting with, you know, family wealth, multi-generational fortunes. But it kind of has an open-ended, infinite horizon, if you want to really look at it. It can be lost, destroyed, confiscated, and so on. I've seen it. But it can also go on and compound and compound and compound.
So, and I use this without really thinking about it in the moment, but I know this is another thing that we've connected over in some of our email and written exchanges. This idea of like immortality, or this idea of spirit in these things. And especially when we talk to multi-generational families, or we talk about people who are building something bigger than them. And I'll give you the benefit of this too. This is a rescheduled recording that we're doing right now, because I had to spend some time at a funeral with family this week. And we also lost Charlie Munger this week, and all these other things are happening in the world. And I was thinking a lot about our conversation about immortality, which I think ties to this. And I was thinking about this yesterday at this funeral, where immortality, the soul of these things, how Berkshire Hathaway can be the whaling industry reborn into this other thing and now manifest in Apple and who knows what beyond. Immortality is like the understanding of the finiteness of our lives, the finiteness of our capital, or the reach that it has in our lifetime. But the sooner we become comfortable with what exists outside of our lifetime, then we can scale that up and we can scale that down to basically see like the finiteness of so many things. And when we understand that there's this connection, there's this birth and rebirth, this whole story, this whole cycling thing, then we can start to look for ways that spirit tracks on through. And the more we understand the way that spirit tracks on through, the more we start to see deaths or ends as, you know, new beginnings or transitions and whatever else. And this link between family wealth and investments we make and the people we help and the lives that we're all trying to build, it's a really profound thing to just see that connection everywhere.
I've been thinking about, you know, there are all kinds of capitals that we think about, right? You and I talk quite a bit about the financial capital, but there's the social, intellectual, and so on. Jay Hughes, who's a mentor to me, and I'm sure you've heard his name, he talks about the various capitals. But I'm thinking about the intellectual capital that we accumulated as a civilization. You and I go to school, and we have all the Greek and Roman philosophers available to us, and everybody since, and a couple of people before. And to imagine that with every generation, we have to erase it all and start from scratch, that's a very scary thought, that we have to reinvent the wheel, the triangle, and everything else. We're building on generations and generations of accumulated intellectual capital. But with financial capital, you know, we know, you and I, for our profession, a handful of families that were able to keep their wealth over multiple generations. But I kind of call it a miracle of nature, because most people really start from scratch with every generation. At least it's been the experience for many people in Poland, where I grew up. Sure. Two world wars, you know, 50 years of communism, hyperinflation, and everything in between that you can imagine. So it wasn't burned, lost, confiscated. Then it was, you know, hyperinflated away and lost. So wealth preservation was not available, not an option. And for multiple generations, I've heard stories of, you know, wealth created and lost and lost and lost. So for me, my focus was on, if there is wealth to be created, what can I do to preserve it? What are the ways to preserve it so that the next generation doesn't have to start from scratch? It's kind of, I have this image of burning all the books that with every generation, we all have to discover everything all over again. It's kind of the same for a lot of families that start each generation with almost nothing. People live paycheck to paycheck, but they really start with nothing. And these days with student debt, they actually start in the negative, which is, you know, a scary thought, and it has a huge impact on what kind of decisions you make. What can we do not to start from scratch every time? That's been a big focus for me and an area that I'm fascinated with.
It's really interesting because that side of like human capital and, mm-hmm. and maybe that's the most important thing. And this goes back to the hollowed out, empty industrial buildings that we both grew up around. Mm-hmm. The most valuable non-financial asset is curiosity. And whatever we can do to foster curiosity, that is the ultimate bootstrapping engine inside of all of our hearts, heads, and minds, is like that curiosity to go make the new thing. Mm-hmm. And it almost always starts with a curiosity of like reinventing an old thing first, trying to understand mm-hmm. an old thing from pieces that are there. Mm-hmm. I think our mutual friend, my friend Ben Hunt, pulled this out of me. We've been doing this podcast together, breaking news. Ben's a fascinating guy because he has a way of weaseling ideas like halfway into my head and then something totally new falls out. So this will probably be a piece I'll probably write in the coming weeks. There's already a draft of it started, but I realized it's much deeper than I originally thought, which is curiosity. Like there's just a burned out building right now. And I'm like, oh, there's something fun here, but I have to unearth my way through it till I have something that I want to share about it. Cause this is a complicated one. Did you read Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene from forever ago?
Yes. I remember that one. What about it?
Oh, okay. So, and I'm fascinated by stuff like, and I'll throw out like Neil Howe for a second too. Like I'm fascinated. Probably the thing that finally got me to read The Fourth Turning was finding out that like he was the one who coined millennials.
I didn't know that.
So as an either elder millennial or like a baby Gen Xer, like I'm right on that line. I think you are too, actually.
So am I. I don't belong.
we don't belong. We're in this nether region with funny experiences. Wilkes-Barre, by the way, very Polish town. I grew up with a lot of polka. So
there is an airport there, right?
Yeah, Avoca, the Wilkes-Barre Scranton International Airport.
I fly small planes. And I think
you
it's
might
one
have flown
of the
out of. There's actually an even smaller airport. Like they fly right outside this window of my house.
I think my solo flight was to one of those airports in Pennsylvania, and I'm forgetting right now the name. But when you brought it up, I think this was the airport where I flew, and there were big planes taking off, and I was by myself. I was a student pilot. Since I was a kid, one of my passions, apart from walking around abandoned textile mills, was to be a pilot. And I got my private license outside of New York, and my solo flight, you have to do a solo flight without an instructor, was to a triangle to Pennsylvania and then up to Stewart in New York.
Really?
New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, three states in one morning. And I remember leaving the airport and all the valleys were covered with fog. And I was afraid that airport will be all covered with fog. And I called the airport and I said, listen, I'm a student pilot. I'm a bit nervous.
I'd like to live today. I'm choosing life.
Are you guys under some fog? Because I can't see any of the valleys in my way. And they say, no, it's clearing up here and come in. So they welcome me. But anyways, just a side story. That's the name.
I'm not going to completely derail us, but the other like our age side story that happens. Do you know what famous movie crosses through that theater, which also has a weird Polish connection to it too?
I don't know. It's not Top Gun. That's California.
No. This is possibly similar in box office size, but way more disappointing in like depth of.
Is that the De Niro one, Robert De Niro?
No. So it is the classic film Home Alone.
Really? Oh, I thought it was filmed in Chicago.
Well, so what happens is she gets, if you remember John Candy's part, and John Candy is Gus Polinski, the Polka King. And that sign of good faith actually is in the Wilkes-Barre Scranton Airport. And if I'm remembering correctly. And so like the character getting shown the good nature thing happens one of the few times we do something positive in a movie in my area. And then it was that. It was this beautiful, beautiful show of humanity as the Polka King in the Wilkes-Barre Airport.
I remember.
Shows a mother one step closer to her son.
Wow. That's a fun movie. I like to rewatch that one. But before you completely derail this conversation.
No. Take me back to Richard Dawkins, because that was the original source of this.
Okay, tell me.
Okay, so Dawkins also introduces more pointless trivia. Do you know what, just like how coined millennials, do you know what word Dawkins famously coined in The Selfish Gene?
No, tell me.
So he coins the word meme in 1976.
Oh, wow.
He invents the word meme. And he invents meme to basically explain this idea of like a cultural copy. And very, very much struck me when I first heard and read this years ago. And it just has like been in the back of my brain a lot lately, because it's the idea of like a meme is just a copy. And it's what we do in culture to spread ideas. And this was his whole point. And he was trying to say like, genes, and he talks about altruism and other stuff, just still well worth revisiting the book if you haven't lately. But it's this idea that like genes are the things that are responsible for our evolution, where memes are the things that are responsible for our culture, but inevitably they like feed into each other in various ways. So what's really interesting is we use memes to copy things. We use memes when we're being curious about things or trying to figure stuff out. But we need our genes. We need our makeup. We need our creativity to create. And I really love this idea that we internally and in our smallest groups cooperatively and competitively have genes to force our own evolution. But at many times that's bookended by the cultural copying we do, our mimetic behavior, before, like, and after those creative periods and urges. It's a really interesting finality around it too. And I'll give you my one other musical story if you want related to this.
Tell me.
If you want to indulge me even one step further on this.
I was going to ask you about the music and investing connection, big picture idea, because somehow in the last few weeks, I came across a couple of people in my life that somehow see that music and investing rhymes, and your life is kind of between the two worlds. If you indulge me, tell me more about this connection about, you know, music and investing, two parts of your life and world and thinking.
So I want to answer this first, and then I'm going to attempt to answer this other idea inside of it. So you're helping me already. You might be helping me write this piece in real time here.
Oh, wow.
So music and investing, or music and business, or music and anything where we're helping other people to understand the world of building assets or spending them down, is music teaches you how to practice. Music teaches you the value of persistence. And music teaches you that patterns are everywhere. You just have to look for them. So it's this idea, again, of practice. Like, are you willing to put your nose down and just do the thing over and over and over again? Are you willing to be persistent? Because the only way practice pays off is this, if you persistently do it.
Right.
And then you're training yourself in that persistent practice to see patterns. So to connect it back to the memes and genes thing, you're familiar with the musical act, the Beatles, I imagine, right?
Yes. Familiar.
Have you seen the last Beatles song, the video that's been everywhere in the last few weeks?
I don't think so. No.
This is one of those things where you realize how small, how like small and big your world is at the same time.
No, you're
just came up in a conversation.
doesn't watch any news.
If you have a bunch of music friends, you get a bunch of like text messages and trade a bunch of emails and then listen to a bunch of podcasts about a new, the new Beatles song. But apparently, like, outside of my musical friend circles, I'm just finding out in the last week, because I'm talking about this a lot, all these people are like, I had no idea.
Today, even more people will know about it, but share with me and the audience.
Okay. So Are you familiar with, or are you aware of Get Back, the Beatles documentary that Peter Jackson did in the last few years? Are you familiar with that existing?
I know that it exists. I don't recall it, but yeah.
It's okay. You don't need to go watch it. If you love that stuff, you go watch it. But if not, you don't need to. The cool thing about this, and it's also weird because there is a financial overlap here. Mm-hmm. Get Back is probably one of the first commercial applications of AI. So there's a huge machine learning component to the technology harnessed by Peter Jackson and his team to actually use AI in a way that it hadn't really been done before in such like a commercially useful way. Mm-hmm. And the documentary is basically a series of like video and audio things that were found that were just kind of like sitting in a vault. And Peter Jackson was able to like using this, like, pull stuff apart, figure out how it fit together, stitch timestamp stuff together that otherwise could not have been done by any human, but with code and machine learning, they were able to do this. So the whole documentary only exists because of some of the advents in pre-GPT AI, mind you, too. So now in a semi post-GPT world, but also what they did is, so there was this one song that had been evading the Beatles for decades. And so in the 70s, John Lennon sits down, he writes this song Now and Then. He actually doesn't even write the whole song. He writes part of a song on a hissy tape deck and it just goes into a box. And John Lennon famously from 1975 to 1980, he had the birth of his son. He takes complete hiatus from music. He basically releases nothing in that window of time. And this tape just keeps getting pulled out every time they're going to do a new box set. Basically, this gets pulled out and like, can we do something with this? Can we re-release or re-record or whatever? And nothing ever happens until this year. And about a year ago, they were able to take the original demo that John Lennon recorded. They were able to take this really bad recording and basically extract enough of his voice, separate out the piano part. This is a huge deal technologically. And then Paul McCartney and Ringo, who are both still alive, with some stuff from Harrison, were able to like piece together this new last Beatles song. And it's not that like the song's not the greatest. The Beatles broke up in 1970. So a John Lennon song from 1977 was never intended to be a Beatles song, but they're forcing this together and whatever. That's not the judgment here. The point is they made this thing. Now they have this video and the video really was messing with my head because it's like them all playing this song, but then it shows these like hologram images of them next to each other. So it's like, you know, like here's Paul through the ages and he's singing and now here's younger Paul next to him and then younger Paul a few years later next to him and then John Lennon making fun of Paul and another thing. And it's cute, but it's kind of weird. The realization and like the rabbit hole this threw me down was like, wait, how many years were the Beatles really active for? Because they all kind of look almost the same age when you see all the older versions of themselves next to them. But like, I forgot how consolidated this was. So, and I'm not going to get this exactly right. Do you know how long like the Beatles were productive for?
I want to say 5 years.
Yeah, it was like 7 years. Like literally like 1962 or 63 to like 1969, 1970, and it's over. And in that period of time, you literally go from like Love Me Do and whatever all the way up to like Revolver and Rubber Soul and Sgt. Pepper's and like that's friggin' crazy. And so I'm going to tie this back together. I promise. So the point is like pre-1963, the Beatles are doing their cover band shtick. And all they're doing is they're out there in the world covering other bands. The 10,000 hours, whatever you want to think about it is, it's pure mimetic behavior. They're just copying other forms of popular music.
Right.
For some reason, 1962-ish to like 1970-ish, they all of a sudden hit stride and go through a period of rapid evolution. It's no longer a revolution of just like spinning memes anymore. They evolve. And when you watch this video and you see the different versions, you see the evolution of the Beatles over time and like in a really cool visual way. And then what happens afterwards is like post 1970 of the solo stuff, but the Beatles just becomes a business in like 1970. Like big capital B Beatles still exists today as probably like a $1 billion enterprise.
Right.
But the wild thing is that you have the memes in the early 60s, 50s into the 60s. Then you have the genes, you have the evolution of the Beatles, 62, 63 to 70-ish. And then the memes just take over again. And the thing that I think bothered me about this video at first and this song was like, this is just a copy of a copy of a copy of what the Beatles are. But what the video showed me, thanks to AI, is it reminded me of just like the insane evolutionary beauty that was this band that, God, did that progress deeply and quickly in a beautiful and profound way. And we're still facing the reverberations of it today because they did the practice. They did it persistently. They were able to spot those patterns, and we're only just understanding a new way to apply those patterns today. How cool is that?
It's very cool, but it makes me think that you just described a lifetime of any investor that at first wants to be just like Peter Lynch or Buffett wanted to be like Ben Graham. And I'm sure Ben Graham had his mentor. I think William Green had this one episode where he was talking about mentors of mentors. He would go and ask people that we admire who are already, you know, 50, 60, 70 years into the career, who would say, you would ask them, who was the person for you when you were 20 that inspired you? It might have been a name that we've never heard of, but it was somebody that inspired them. So we want to be just like our mentors. And then we realized, no. I have to find my own voice. And that's when that magic happens that you describe. That's the creative leap that happens where you take everything you've learned, trying to copy everybody else, and you realize this is my voice. And I can see it in music. Somehow I was thinking about chefs and cooking. You watch those cooking shows and they show celebrities and they say how the first half of their career, they want to be just like the best French chef. And then they go home and they include the Nordic or the South American or the Australian flavor. And they go back to New Zealand and they want to pick up mushrooms and different roots that are local. It's kind of like investing in music. I see those huge overlaps where that's the creative leap. I think that's what you were alluding to. But yeah. I like the way you described it.
And I love that idea too of like the mentors of the mentors and looking back, because in a weird way, that's like, so that's what the Beatles were doing, because they were playing all those Motown and soul hits and everything else in that first stage. It was the copying where they honed the craft, the persistent practice of the things they wanted to emulate, the spotting of the patterns. And then their evolution was formed by like really pressing on those patterns more and pressing on those patterns like in the studio and doing the classical arrangements, then getting interested in classical composition and the cage and the other stuff that all gets applied and how that all gets thrown into the mix. And they want to just press harder, press harder, press harder until the band finally implodes, which that's kind of just what happens in everything, every natural cycle. This goes back to the idea of understanding like infinity by understanding the concept of what's finite. As you understand, these things have births and deaths and then rebirths in different ways.
I like that. It makes me think of a certain continuity, you know, in music, but in investing, you talked about business. I got to work with people that worked with people that remember the Great Depression. And I heard stories repeated. So there's a certain intellectual heritage, you know, it gets passed on. And through those stories, I think we learn. And I think in music, in other fields that happens. But I remember those stories of 1929 of, I guess you would say a mentor of a mentor who sold everything before 1929 because the market didn't make sense to him. And he ended up buying a chicken farm. And I just have this image of him, you know, packing up, selling those paper certificates and driving up to Vermont, buying a chicken farm. And then after a few years, he came back. And then from the debris of the Great Depression, he built a small fortune by buying things that were hugely discounted. And those stories you collect, and I think in music, you have the patterns that you collect. And eventually you get this kind of license and permission to say, oh, this part is really me. That's the creative part. Which leads me to the Cultish Creative project that you have going on and the idea of a personal archive. So if you indulge me, tell me more, what's that all about? What's a personal archive and how it plays a role in your personal and professional life? What's it all about?
So in the great tradition of doing things by accident, but doing them persistently, I had a sense, a realization, and this goes back to like 2010, 2012, 2013, 14, wherever. And I realized, as I think a lot of people do at that point in their lives. So like I'm coming into my 30s and whatever else, and it's full fire hose consumption mode on. I'm working in finance at this point. I know that I'm going to continue working in finance at that point, or I think I am. And so I'm in just like absorb as much as possible. And did you ever hit the point where like you were consuming so much that you felt like you almost lost the ability to think?
Yes. And it really rhymes with my early years of getting my professional experience investing, where I would go to every single meeting where they would let me attend. And
because I did that too. I can relate.
And they would say, well, this is just for the partners. And I would say, I'll just sit in the back. I'm not going to say anything. You won't even notice. I'm just curious. And I would sit in meetings with mining companies talking about the technology they use to find the resource in the ground. And I found it fascinating that I would go to the next meeting where they explained the branding of this new product for a particular demographic. And I thought I was going through the process of collecting as much as I can to figure out what is it that really resonates with me. Not I'm just curious about, but truly resonates with me. And I think it's an ongoing process, but I think I can relate to those early years where I just wanted to know it all. Everything, I just wanted to know it all because I was trying to figure out who am I? What kind of an investor I'm going to be? Or a person in general. I think it's a whole discovery.
So I think in that mode of discovery, you start figuring out ways how to like record stuff and you start taking notes and you start jotting stuff away. Mm-hmm. But I realized probably around 2015-ish that the act of just collecting all these notes was I just had all of these notes. And whether they were, the wonderful invention that is the iPhone, the wonderful invention that are computers and other things.
A banker's box, because I had those too, with actual paper and actual folders in there.
There's one of those. Yeah.
Somewhere.
Not just that. I've got paper tickets and other fun things. I've got some fun financial history in a drawer right next to me here. But this idea of I wanted to have a complete thought. And the only way I could think of having a complete thought was I needed to spend more than a minute on something I consumed. And at first I didn't know what I was doing, but the idea was spend a minute and make it a complete thought. And I started doing this just by myself, for myself for a while. And then right around 2017, I decided, you know what I'm going to do is, and I was inspired by Shane Parrish at Farnham Street from back in the financial crisis when it was Berkshire zip code or whatever it was, the website, and somebody sent it to me and Seth Godin and people like this. I was like, there's something about putting it out in the world, even if nobody's going to see it.
Oh, yeah.
But just knowing that it's publicly visible. And so in 2017, I took what was already a private habit for probably a few years and started to say, I want to have one complete thought and I'm going to force myself to make it public, you know, once a day. And so since 2017 on Cultish Creative, cultishcreative.com, I've been putting up a post a day. 2017, haven't missed a day since.
Wow.
And it's this habit of completing a thought. Now I realized literally just a few months ago, some more nuance into this thing. And that's where this expression personal archive comes from, because I realized like on one end of the continuum, you have notes or journal taking or other things that may not be a complete thought and may not be intended to be public.
I see.
And I realized what I was doing was neither of those things anymore. Because a complete thought is a little bit more than like a note might just be like a source quote.
Sure.
And there's great Building a Second Brain, the Tiago Forte book, How to Take Smart Notes. There's a bunch of amazing resources that I've uncovered on this too. But like a note could just be a quote. A personal journal entry might just be like a purge about something, but it's not really a complete thought or something that would later be useful. And then There's also like, so you write a blog post or you write an article or a research report. That doesn't necessarily mean it's getting like published in the world either. Mm-hmm. But if you had the complete thought, you want to store it somewhere. And so a personal archive is intended to exist in this kind of in-between space. Mm-hmm. Where you're taking the idea to form a complete thought. You don't necessarily, you can if you want, but you don't have to publish it to the world in an official sense. But you want to put it on this public shelf so that you can search and access stuff you've written before in complete thought form. You mm-hmm. can share it with somebody else in case they want to look at a complete thought you had. And I think mm-hmm. most critically, the habit, and back to this idea of like the persistent practice of completing notes, mm-hmm. it makes this thing so much easier. Ah. You can communicate with people. You can start a conversation. You've nurtured this curiosity muscle in yourself to a point where, uh-huh. oh my God, I knew we had a bunch of things in common, but the whole like, I never would have related, you know, Poland in the 80s to, you know, Wilkes-Barre in the 80s until he said this thing. And now my there mind is kind of blown that that's there. So this habit of creating it, and I mean, this whole Beatles memes and jeans, Richard Dawkins crazy rabbit hole that I'm in the last couple of days here, like that's the beginning of trying to pull a complete mm-hmm. thought together. Mm-hmm. I don't think enough people stop and do that. You're doing it and you're writing. Like what pushed you over the edge to wanting to start completing thoughts? And mm-hmm. Actually, question for you. Do you differentiate between a completed thought and an uncompleted thought, an incomplete thought?
I think I'm aware of the distinction. And if it's for public consumption, I want to close the loop. I like the idea of just closing the loop.
What closes the loop to you? I'm very, very curious in this question right now.
So there are tiny loops, bigger loops, huge loops, and loops that I will never close. And I just see them as, and it comes from like the simplest idea, a simple task. You know, I have to wash the dishes. You know, it's a beginning and the end, and it's over. But I have to do it again tomorrow because there will be a dinner and so on, right? So the tiny, and I'm being very, you know, mundane things in life, all the way to bigger things. For me, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking immediately of, it's a complete thought in the sense that I'm taking the reader on a short or a longer journey. And sometimes the inspiration can be completely random, but something really stuck in my head and I have to address it. And I can do it just for myself and write it, and it's my journal entry. And it could be a complete thought. It doesn't have to be. I'll be the only one reading it. But if I'm inviting somebody for a 2-minute or a 3-minute or a 10-minute read with me, I feel the obligation that I have to bring this plane back around, back on the ground.
Through the fog in Wilkes-Barre, Boca Airport.
let's lend this. You know, when my instructor was getting tired, he said, like, let's bring it home. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see it. You went for a trip, you saw things, and you're back at your home airport. That's how I see it. But you touched on something bigger, a couple of things. One, for me, you say complete thought, but it's a public thought. And I see it as a flare, you know, like the one that you send out when you're stranded on an island middle of the night and you're hoping that this little boat is going to see you. You send a flare to the sky and you never know who's going to see it. And with today's reach, the synchronicity, serendipity, whatever you want to call it, that can happen. I mean, I have no idea who is listening to us today, but given the people that reach out to me, it's remarkable what kind of people are listening and paying attention to my guests. And I'm grateful for it. Thank you guys. But it's remarkable what happens because all kinds of random connections happen when you send that flare out. And people that are in your life that you didn't know, they know each other, they connect, and different stories and opportunities arise from it, or even just fascinating conversations. So I see it as a flare up to the sky. And yeah, it can invite some criticism, and some people can say, this is nonsense. I don't know why he wrote it. That's okay. But a couple of people will say, and you're, I think, one of the kindest readers out there that will say, oh, this actually inspired something. I never looked at it this way. But related to that, question back to you, and something that you and I talked about before. I wrote an article after we spoke that I called Idea Catcher, because at the time I was inspired by a couple of conversations I was having, and you kind of pushed me over the edge. When I see an idea, I have, at least that's my interpretation, and investing, life, business, anything, that the ideas just kind of travel and I'm responsible for catching them. And if I don't catch them, they'll be gone. It's rare for me that for the idea to really in the same shape and form to come back. They might come back in some way, but once I see it, I just have this desperate need to record it. I don't know how I'm going to use it. And I'll just write it down. And sometimes it's a phrase that I read it later and I don't know what it meant, but I have the obligation to write it down because I know it will be gone. How do you look at it? Those ideas that come to you, you have this belief that if it's a big one, it's going to keep on coming back to you. That was my impression.
Yes. So I'm a big fan in, and I learned this from writing music, from songwriting years ago, like that ideas are infinite. It's this idea, like they just keep hitting you. So it's, you'll never, if you embrace that abundance mindset, you'll never run out of ideas. There's no shortage. It's just harnessing some good ones. And maybe reflect back on this because this is, you pushed me or I pushed you over the edge and you grabbed my foot. And now we're both tumbling forward into the abyss here. Something that really has caught me since I've started calling this a personal archive and writing about it. And I've got this whole like stacking of posts that sometime early next year, I'm going to try to reassemble in how I'm thinking about this because it's really, it means a lot to me. Because I'm realizing something I've been working on for multiple years. This is like the thread that connects all of it. So this is something I learned. This is something I learned from going through therapy, reading a lot about cognitive behavioral therapy, and also learning a lot about motivational interviewing, which is a cognitive behavioral therapy source technique that I use in my professional work all the time with clients, because it's a really great way to help people do things they say they want to do to help pull them forward. And maybe this drags us later into Campbell and Young and stuff like that too. But it's this idea that we have to notice with the idea when it's resonating with us. I say there's three things. This is from cognitive behavioral therapy. There's a feeling, there's an emotion, or there's a behavior, or any combination of the three. Not everybody's going to sit around reading Brené Brown books, apparently, like I am. do you differentiate at all in your head between, this is not to put you on the spot with a test, between feelings, emotions, and behaviors? Do you differentiate between those in your head right now?
I do. The feelings and emotions are close in my head, but tell me the difference. How do you see the difference?
That's okay. And this is one that I have to, like I had to write it on something to keep reminding myself of this, and I'll get to the point of like pulling these poles apart. So when we think feelings, we're thinking external. We're thinking our view of something in the world. There was a terrorist attack and that makes me sad or angry or whatever else at the situation that happened. Feelings are external. Emotions, however, are like internal. So I'm mad that this person hit that person, but it makes me feel, my emotion is I am sad inside because of just like the hope, this feeling of hopelessness. And then behavior obviously is what I'm going to do with that. What's so important about catching an idea and then the feeling, emotion, or behavior attached to the idea as we ran into it is it opens a loop for us to complete that thought if we're willing to look for it. And the place it opens the loop is like, you can think about it on a string because, or a continuum, if you will. And every continuum has these two poles. And so if something made me, you know, angry, then there's another side of that extreme, which even if it's just not angry, you decide what that pole is. We have a gap. So it made me angry. I started off as not angry, but then it made me angry. Maybe I started off as happy. Maybe I started blissfully unaware of the situation or conveniently forgetting of the situation, but then it made me angry. The minute I can identify those poles, I've identified in a story what's, I mean, this is all music. This is every pattern everywhere. It's just tension and resolution over and over and over again. That progression is the tension. And if I know what resolves the tension, now I have a transformation to pull that idea through. And every completed loop is a way of identifying that tension and resolution process. And that's what makes it sit for somebody. So when you're like idea catching idea, which I love, the thing that separates it from just being like, again, a quote blowing in the breeze is like an obvious example of these things. Yours, uh-huh. Like, that's profound. Okay. Why is that profound? Mm-hmm. Find the two poles, find the tension and resolution, and now create something. It could be one sentence long, but mm-hmm. that pulls that tension and resolution all the way through. What mm-hmm. sense of that do you make? Please react to this in real time. Give me some feedback.
I'm fascinated with the idea of closing loops. And I use that word, and my wife, Megan, makes fun of me because I want to close loops. And I don't know why. It's a certain satisfaction around the smallest task, the biggest thing that I just want to close the loop and then bring the plane around and land it.
Yeah.
And it's such a big part of what you're talking about. But the friction and the resolution, I think the whole world is built around it. And a lot of things are built around it. The inspiration, and I want to dive in a little bit deeper with you. We all have a very different experience of the world. I realize that now. I was talking to somebody how we can both look at the same set of financial statements or any data, and we will walk away with a different impression of it. It's a very individual experience. But at the same time, I realize that the same ideas appear, and obviously the big ones, you know, like the invention of the radio, appear at the same time. You and I might have touched on it last time we spoke off record, how like the world maybe is ready for an idea. And the reason why I'm a little bit obsessed about catching those ideas, because I feel like for some reason I'm hearing this voice and this idea, and it's a product of maybe something I read yesterday. Maybe it's a product of a conversation I had with you. Maybe it's a question that Matt asked me and still at 2 a.m. I'm thinking about it. But I feel responsible for catching it, writing it down, not in a public personal archive, but in some sort of an archive that I keep, that I have to look at it and see where it goes. And it could be an investment idea. It could be an article. It could be a chapter for a book. Hmm. But it's a sense of, I can't let it go.
So this, I think this goes back to, it's an awareness of the patterns. And the more you interact with the world, the more you invite those patterns in. And I say that in the most woo-woo sounding way possible with that meaning. Mm-hmm. The patterns are bigger than us. The thing that's not bigger than us, and what's really interesting about the way you framed it, is back to that idea of the act of practice and the act of persistence. Mm-hmm. Because you and I can both go and read, we could read the same financial reports. We could look at the same company and go back through the K's and the Q's for the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. But our separate experiences in the practice and our separate experiences in the persistence mm-hmm. are going to shape the patterns that we each see as emergent. Some will rhyme. Some will be in conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. When we map them forward, we might see totally different timescales of this thing. Mm-hmm. I look at the Beatles last song as mm-hmm. basically a failure of musical creativity and a giant success of technological creativity. The mm-hmm. actual creativity is what Peter Jackson did with this technology that he just used for a different purpose. I could care less about a song that was never supposed to be a Beatles song getting recorded.
Right.
But that's my view. Somebody else can have a totally opposing view to that because they practiced, they rumbled with the data in a different way. Mm-hmm. They looked at all the things and they had a different amount of persistence or none at all. I say this non-critically, like you didn't even know that that song existed. That's amazing to me. I there love that this wasn't even on your radar. The most popular pop band in the history of the world is a new song and uh-huh. people don't even know it happened. That's so cool to me.
not people, just me. You know, I wrote an article that you might like. I called it Selective Ignorance. And I realized how I went from the stage that you described earlier, how I wanted to know everything because I didn't know what's worth knowing. And it's worth knowing, meaning in a broad term, like at the moment, I have to choose where I'm going to put my attention. And there are some things I'm going to miss out on. It's the price I pay. But I noticed that if I'm supposed to know something, somebody will tell me, like Matt told me about the song today and the movie and the story. But I feel like sometimes I can relax a little bit about the pursuit of at least especially the short-lived news flow. When FTX imploded, and I mentioned it in the article, and I never get his name right. SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried, Friedman Bank.
We all know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Sam.
Sam.
I had no idea who he was. I mean, I completely tuned out the whole crypto world, and I don't want to offend anybody. I mean, whoever likes Bitcoin, more of it for you, because I'm not interested, but I completely tuned out that part of the universe. And I do it more regularly and in a more disciplined way these days, because I feel like my attention is precious and my time is, you know, finite, and I have to choose where I'm going to deploy my resources. So there are many things that I don't even think I have to have an opinion about, which confuses some people. I want to have a very good understanding of very few things. But if you ask me about a random stock, like some people think that because I invest and you throw at me some microcap name from, I don't know, Brazil, and you say, oh, you've heard of it. I said, no, I've never heard of it. It's outside of my, you know, if you talk to a doctor who is a cardiologist and you ask him about some, you know, gastro issues, and he might not know about the newest medication in that field because he's specialized in what's going on with the heart. You have to choose the area where you're going to devote your time. And I think maybe I have gone too far that I tune out so much. I actually just got an Apple News Plus subscription out of curiosity, just to eyeball all the headlines across all the magazines and all the newspapers to see what am I missing. And if really something calls my name, I'm going to read it. Because I felt like back in the day when I was in the office, there would be a bunch of a pile of newspapers. And then when I was in college, there would be a pile of free newspapers they would give to students. And school after school, and I went to school in three different countries, and I would sit there, and I remember my school in Paris, there were all the French newspapers, and I would just eyeball, like, what should I know? Oh, you know, this happened with Renault and different companies, and I don't have that anymore. Like, you know, I don't have the physical experience of eyeballing headlines, so I was going through this new experience of how do I not miss out on something relevant, but at the same time not devote, you know, hours and hours to trying to keep up with every little news out there, because everything is news these days and not everything is worth knowing. But I have Matt in my life who's going to keep me abreast of anything that's happening in music. So
random, probably unrelated hot takes on weird, obscure corners of the world. As I recently just watched REM's 1991 MTV Unplugged part of it this morning and fell down another rabbit hole. I gotta say this too, though. I think that's so important. So I had a realization somewhat like this in the last few years too, where I didn't want things occupying my attention because I wanted input for the complete thoughts, but not to get so absorbed or similarly, like, because what you could have spent several years of your life researching, like, I don't know, Bitcoin or crypto type stuff or whatever. And then how much of that's, I don't want to say how much of the knowledge is worthless, because the knowledge may not be, even if the investments burned you, or maybe you made $1 billion and you're on an island somewhere. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the idea of, like, what catches your attention. So I had this love-hate relationship with the Apple. What podcast app do you use? This is an unpaid sponsorship opportunity here. Where do you listen to podcasts primarily?
Spotify.
Okay. Have you been doing this a long time? Like, are you a lifelong Spotify person or 10-year Spotify person?
I've used Spotify for a long time. Yeah, I like it.
Okay. Yeah. So the Apple podcast app, like, I was stubbornly attached to it. And every year or two. And, like, I was attached to it from the iPod days when I had to plug my iPod in. And that's a whole other story, how, like, podcasts and audiobooks may have helped save my life at one point. But this idea of, like, plugging the iPod in and downloading them one at a time and having to, like, delete some songs to make room and all that. I went through that for a while. But I hung on to this thing, but the app would just randomly, like, crash, and it would lose, like, all, like, it wouldn't just lose, like, your episodes. It would lose, like, your whole feed. So I'd have this, like, assembled feed of who I wanted to see new episodes from. And this was back in where I felt like I had to listen to every episode of the 5 and then 10 and then whatever number of things I was listening to. And it would just wipe me out. And I finally realized that, like, the wipeout actually had value, because I would have to I would have to start over. And when I would start over, I wouldn't remember all the things, but I would remember some of them. And then I would find new things to soak them up. And that just kept happening over and over again. And finally somebody had showed, they showed me their Spotify on their phone or whatever. And I remember a friend of mine saying, like, this is how I save episodes. And I was like, the Apple app doesn't really let me do that the same way. And so I got a Spotify membership, which primarily is where I listen to podcasts still to this day. And so this is my current take. I don't even know where I could see how many podcasts feeds I'm subscribed to, but I do the same thing with certain types of like news curation or email, like summary aggregator newsletters as I can. I oversubscribe to those and I oversubscribe and I will not every day, not religiously, like skim. Same with like I open Spotify, I look at the new feed and I just, I do one of these. I do the scroll and I go, that has my attention today.
Oh, wow.
And the wild thing about that type of pattern searching is because it's unique to whatever is going on in my own practice and my own persistence and pursuit of this stuff. And then I get sometimes completely sucked into an idea. And then when you write about it, you share a little bit out in public, you go, and I think this is the way that I found you. It was like, holy crap, me and Tom Morgan are both obsessing over this like Campbell Young crossover. And the two things that come out of that is he's like, you have to read this Catafalque or however you say his name book. And I'm like, I didn't even know this existed, but now apparently this is the unity that I've been looking for in this issue. And oh, by the way, you got to check out this guy, Bogomil Baranowski, because like, hey, he's also doing the family office thing. He talks about all this like immortal investing stuff. I think you guys would get along.
Tom, and Tom is a great guy.
But that only happens from doing the scroll and having the practice and the persistence of writing the posts, putting them out there in the world and going, what's the pattern that's locking up with me?
Somebody had this post the other day, how you have to leave room for, and he wrote random conversations in life.
And absolutely.
And I feel like it's really interesting because I was just talking to somebody earlier today, how eventually everybody in your life, we gravitate to the same people, but I mean it in a very broad terms. It's not that we all do the same thing, right? But it has certain type of, you know, personality, and we could be in completely different fields. Like we could have no overlap in terms of actual work that we do. But it's interesting to have those random moments where new people pop in into your life. And then Tom and I had lunch in New York and we had a fascinating conversation, and he's a power connector that introduced me to a lot of people. And then there are funny moments when he says, oh, I met this person. I didn't know they know you. And it's so there are those moments where you have to allow that kind of serendipity to happen, because, you know, speaking of ideas, but connections and people, fun things can happen, and it opens up your world to a new way of seeing things. What I like about this podcast, it's a couple of things, but I like that it's a longer form. I mean, it's not hours and hours, but it's around an hour. And I feel like when the audience invests an hour into something, it's a two-way thing. One is that I invested already a few hours for this to happen. You're investing hours for this to happen. So it's a peak of, you know, of an iceberg. But they're giving us attention for an hour of their day. And I'm very grateful for it. I feel very blessed that they do this. It's very different than eyeballing, you know, a headline or a tweet that's three words and has some sort of a big emotional charge and brings out a feeling about the world out there. And it took 3 seconds to write it. It's, you know, I have a lot of respect for, you know, books and longer form that actually took a lot of thought to prepare and produce and create and send it out to the world. And you're writing, you know, there might be short posts that you have, but I can tell that you've given a lot of thought to it. And sometimes it might have taken weeks for you to assemble the different pieces and build your loop and say, you know, this is what I want to share with you. But I find, yeah, the more time you put in, the more attention I know that I'll give it.
That idea of that persistent practice is, that's where it shows up. There's this thing I learned when I was in college, and I was studying jazz guitar amongst other things. And there's this expression that I've written about recently, so you might have seen this. It's woodshedding, or going in the shed. Are you familiar with this term?
No, tell me.
So in music, this idea of like hitting the shed or woodshedding, all the variations you can imagine, is this idea of like going and practicing. And in particular in jazz, like you'll be looking at like a phrase or something that you want to not only be able to play, like on guitar, I want to get it out of my fingers and get it out of my hand in a way that sounds right. So there's like the technical proficiency aspect. But then, as is usually the case with jazz, you want to use it in the world. You want to be able to improvise with this new lick, this new thing, this new tune that you just learned, like on the bandstand in front of people. You want to be able to improvise with this thing. And I had a teacher tell me, whatever you're working on in the shed will not show up in your playing organically for 6 months ever. Like no matter what. And he was like, he was 40 or 50 years old telling me this when I'm, you know, 20 years old. He's going, whatever you're working on in the shed, it's 6 months in the shed before it shows up in the world. And this was really stuck with me because this just, it never goes away. I can sit and something can come out in this conversation in this hour, but it can be something that I've been working on, however consciously or unconsciously, you know, for 40 years, let alone something that was practiced 6 months ago. And this whole idea that I can try to force it out in a performance, I can force the lick and do it, but it's going to be one of those things where it's like, I tried, but it's not the same. Yeah. It's not the same as the moment where you're doing it and it just comes out naturally. And you were like, did I just do that? Did I just play that Grant Green lick? Like in this moment, and it sounded good and worked. And like, nobody looked at me like, oh, he's just copping that thing again. So the time in the shed vastly outweighs the time in our interactions, but the brevity or the simplicity of those reactions, like we are the sum of all those parts that led up to it. And it's just such a beautiful concept. I think you were just explaining it just gorgeously right there.
I like that. I want to bring up something that came across a couple of your posts, and I have some quotes for you that I wanted to share. You talk about, well, let's take it all at the same time. I want to hear about Rick Rubin. Rick Rubin wrote a book that a couple of people recommended to me, and I read it. And Rick Rubin comes from music industry. And I thought that he will have lessons for me in terms of, you know, life. But when I was reading his book, I was thinking about investing and just my professional life, how, you know, creative it can really be. And I want to overlap it with, you write about Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey. And you have this one sentence that I really like. You said how the markets cannot exist without marketing. I mean, it's all a story. Everything is a story. And we were talking about, you know, loops. When you watch a good movie and you pause at the end and you're thinking, why was it a good movie? I mean, it's a silly story. A boy met a girl. There was something in the way. They overcame it. And at the end, you kind of feel good. But you knew where it's going. But they took you on a journey. Can you talk about that, the creative process, the journey, and how, and I'm going to throw this in, but Rory Sutherland has this quote that you also mentioned, a flower is just a weed with a marketing budget. I mean, let's talk about all those three. What comes to your mind?
All right. We're going to try to pull all those things together. So I think the great insight of music production, and that was what I aspired to be. So from a tender young age of watching the Run DMC and Aerosmith video on my precious parents' 6-inch black and white TV set in the early days of MTV and just being floored by this because I grew up, my parents loved Aerosmith and here's this song that I already knew, but like presented in this new cool way. And just like that blows my mind. And then I fall in love with like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who become this huge gateway to all these other things. Cause I'd be listening to them and my mom would be like, oh, that's a Sly song. Oh, that's a Stevie song. Oh, that's this. The Red Hot Chili Peppers opened all these doors. And then my parents' 45 collections, I discover Johnny Cash as a small child. I fall because I'm like, oh, Shel Silverstein books and Johnny Cash. Here's a guy making songs out of these children's poems that I love. How cool is A Boy Named Sue? How cool is this? As a novelty in between like acts or sets when we would play these shows, I'd be the goofy, you know, 15-year-old with the guitar, even though my voice was never deep enough to sing those Johnny Cash lines, but doing a cover of Folsom Prison in like the mid-90s. So Rick Rubin becomes this person, and he produced all those artists that I just mentioned at one point in their career or another, who could help. And he has this quote that how an artist, I'm going to butcher this. It's something about like, however you see yourself, whatever frame you put around yourself, like the frame is too small. And the thing I realized when I finally became aware of Rick Rubin, thanks to the internet in probably like the mid to late 90s, was to go, why does this guy see stuff across all these genres, across all these idioms? And he takes the frame away and he allows these artists to self-discover who they are. Mm. And I decided I wanted to be a producer because of that. And that was primarily what I went to school for, was I have a music production and engineering degree with the idea. And I worked in recording studios for a number of years. And that's just always been a side fascination and interest. Uh-huh. However, this idea of removing the frame, and I want to relate it back to this, the Campbell sense of the hero's journey and this arc. We see the pattern of the arc and how it fits together, but the expression of the arc and the experience of when you're in the arc and you can't see it, that's the part you need to learn to see through. And people like Rick Rubin, people like other sides of the music business, Dante Ross, I've got a bunch of posts about Dante in the last couple of weeks because his book blew my mind. Like Rick Rubin as a producer, he's an A&R, artists and repertoire. That's another role in the music business. And he just is, it's like, how were you in every phase of my entire life? I just can't comprehend how you stayed on the crest of, yeah, you want to talk about like amazing growth investors, A&R, Dante as an A&R is like one of the ultimate music scene growth investors of the last 40 years. Wow. Like he's a Peter Lynch for the music industry. This hero's journey, this idea that like we see where those things are, understanding that framework, if you put that producer hat on, if you think this way, you step back to see that broader pattern and you start to understand where in the journey someone is and whether you're looking at that for investments or you're talking to clients and watching them figure out stuff, we're not trying to like push them forward to the next thing. That's not our job. It's not our job to like will markets forward.
Right.
It's our job to sit back, understand the broader pattern, understand the death and the rebirth and that whole cycle, and just position ourselves for those secular and cyclical cycles along the way. And so I think that thread between, you know, Campbell and Young and Rick Rubin is that the creative act is to be able to see the broader patterns through conversations with people, understanding where they are in their own practice, their own persistence on their own journeys, and then say, you see this frame around this piece of where you are right now. I understand it in this broader context, not because I'm smarter, just because I'm not living in the shed with you. I'm outside the shed seeing a bigger picture. What can I do to remove some of these limitations away to allow your spirit to progress to the next phase of this journey? That's what I love about the type of work we both do. That's what I love about working with people on bigger projects. That's related to the music production work that I wanted to be able to do before. How do you help the art come out of the person so they look at it and say, that's a true expression of myself that without your help, I don't know if I could have done. And not, again, not because we're the expert or we have all the answers.
Right.
Because you can't create by yourself. Like extra genes all over again. It takes two to tango. We need each other to propel actual like evolution and to move ideas forward. Memes, we can trade memes all day, but that doesn't get anything forward. We can do two sentence tweets, but it's not a 2-hour conversation. Let's not talk for 2 hours today. We need each other to move things forward. And the Rick Rubin, Campbell, Carl Jung, whoever else you want to throw in that mix.
Rory Sutherland.
Rory Sutherland too. Yeah. We need each other to move it forward. You can't talk about markets without talking about marketing. Something I say all the time to clients is this idea that it's all stories. Turtles all the way down, if you want to put it that way, but it's all stories all the way down. And so seeing those stories in stacks, seeing them in this like laddered structure is a way that we can understand, like with markets, one of my favorite things that I ever like learned to ask was, it's like, okay, Like, who's selling this now? Mm-hmm. And who's selling and then who's buying? Because like somebody is deciding on this price. Like with stocks, this is a quoted price. This is not being marked to some proverbial market. This is being marked to a transaction. Who are the buyers and holders on each side of this? And both of them are marketing stories because they're both friggin' good. And that's usually one of like the most disorienting thing early in markets. You hear all this really compelling stuff and you're like, oh my God, obviously. And then somebody else comes along, throws cold water on it. And you're like, oh my God, obviously.
It's sad. And
if we don't have our own practice and persistence, if we haven't put the time into the shed to understand our patterns, then we can get stuck walking in somebody else's footsteps for a real, real long time till we can step back and go, this is the pattern that I want to play with. This is the thing that I want to express.
So many big thoughts and big ideas. I'm trying to keep up and process what you unloaded here, but I think there's so much to it. So when I think of stories, I feel like, you know, everything turns out to be a story. We started talking about loops. And I remember watching movies as a kid, and well, let me put it this way. There were quite a few European productions that frustrated me as a kid, and I didn't know why. And some of them were, you know, maybe I was little and the story was too complicated. But there was this theme and style of movie making at some point where the movie would end before the end. So they would never tell you if the boy met the girl.
Got the girl or whatever. Yeah.
And I don't know why, but it got me thinking when you talked about loops and a hero's story and everything is a story, how there were those movies that were frustrating and I didn't know why they were frustrating. And I got to discover.
Why do you think now?
Because you have to close the loop. You know, it worked out or it didn't work out. But there were so many movies that were ambiguous. And it was up to the audience, they said, for you to decide they met or they didn't meet. It worked out or didn't work out. They lived or they died. And I thought, you just invited me on a journey and you left me stranded. And I always thought it was really frustrating. And now I know as humanity, we have recorded written history of stories told by the Greeks and the Romans. And then, you know, Shakespeare copied them. And he said, I just copied the classics. And then you say every song is a story too. And there's the elements of how it's all built and all the way to a stock investment and even a family story. Every family you meet, they sit down and they talk to you and they say, so many stories I hear. There was this one individual. Usually they moved from somewhere across the country or across the world with limited resources, worked really, really hard and built something. It's the same story that I hear, whether it's Thailand or it's the United States or it's somewhere in Europe or South America, you name it. I've heard this story 1,000 times. And then the family builds on it and it can be something bigger, but there's always a story. And somehow that hero, somebody told me the other day that really resonated with me, how Buddha had to leave the palace to discover himself and find enlightenment. And I think that it's a very powerful idea how we all kind of have to leave home. We might end up coming back, but we have to leave home to find ourselves. And I feel like that story of that one individual that leaves one set of circumstances to build something, there's the same story of, you know, finding that opportunity, enlightenment. There's the other one-liner that I'll drop here, that it's very hard to be a prophet in your, you know, hometown. You kind of have to go and be a prophet somewhere else. I think there's something to it.
Not only think there's something to it, but I think this is also where Carl Jung comes into the equation really helpfully. And it's this idea of like moving from when we're children, we start off with like magical thinking, like we don't understand how the world works or whatever else, but we're in that realm of magic. Mom or dad maybe take care of us or whatever the situation is. It just happens because it just happens that way. And we're children and we accept that as reality. And then we move into our adult phase or our young adult phase of what he calls heroic thinking. And this is heroic in the hero's journey way of, oh, I see the pattern. I know what I'm supposed to do. I know how the world ought to be. And that ought phase is tricky and it can be dangerous in the sense that we can get stuck there. And I think, unfortunately, tragically, a lot of people get stuck in the world ought to be this way phase. Mm-hmm. The midlife crisis, or the ultimate event of, you know, the unifying whatever, this is the hero fighting off the ultimate bad guy, the ultimate tyrant to get the treasure and bring it home, in Campbell's sense. But in Jung's sense, that transformation happens within us, usually requires we've left the hometown, or it's very hard to be a prophet in some way, shape, or form, even if we return to it. And that's when we move into realistic thinking. And it's that mode of life, which is the post-midlife crisis, James Hollis's language, like terminology for this, where post the middle passage, we say, it's not about how the world ought to be anymore. It's just accepting the world as it is.
Mm-hmm. Making the world work for you. There's a quote that I'm forgetting. I mentioned in one of the articles at some point, how if you figure out how the world works, which is easier said than done, and see how it can work in your favor, it will lift you and move you forward. I think that's one of the themes we talked about. And fighting it, I think it's not really helpful.
That's the message. Don't fight it. Hear the music, find the song, see the thing that makes you happy in it, and then just figure out how to have more of that in a realistic way, not in a magical way, not in a forced heroic way. Mm-hmm. Find that music.
Matt, I have one last question for you. I could keep you all day, I know that, but we'll save it for another one follow-up. I want to ask you about your definition of success.
So I think success, back to this idea of the infinity and finite, how you can only understand them next to each other. Mm-hmm. I think success is only determined. It has nothing to do with money. It has very little to do with, if anything, to do with accomplishments. I think success has to do with the patterns that we set forth in our life, the things that we copy, the things that we've created. And did we pass enough forward so that someone else, whether it's your offspring or whether that's the neighbor's kids, or whether it's, you know, Peter Jackson growing up on the Beatles and now being able to bring AI to this situation in a new and novel way, did we take what was practiced? Did we take what was interesting? And did we figure out to do at least one new thing with it to inspire another generation or another person to now copy it again and figure something else out? And success in that way is all those failed businesses and factories around us. That's part of our story. That's part of why you and I are both doing what we're doing with the people we're doing it for. I don't want to look at those things and say they weren't a success. They were a failure. They helped sow the seeds of where we are today. And I think through that lens, that's the ultimate, like, fourth turning optimist's perspective of going, it doesn't matter. You could keep wiping everything out over and over and over again, but it's successes. Did you pass just enough meaning forward, at least for somebody to take it and now build something new off of it?
I love it. It's not about winning or losing. It's about building an infinite game, an infinite pursuit. I like the visual of planting trees for others to enjoy that I brought up more than once in my writing.
One of my favorite metaphors too. I absolutely love it. Yeah.
Matt, thank you so much for today. I'm sure you're going to be back and we'll pick up everything else that we left behind today, but I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Such a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
Wow. You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Sicard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.